Hello and welcome to another episode of PhD Pending, the podcast for early career humanities scholars. My name is Anne Mahler and I have a PhD in English literature. Together, we will deep dive into different aspects of PhD life and explore what it really means to do a PhD in the humanities. We've already made it to yet another season finale of PhD Pending, and to round season 5 up in style, I have invited 3 fellow scholars onto the show to discuss one of the arguably most pressing topics for early career researchers: precarity and job insecurity in academia. Now, we have 3 brilliant guests today. I'm just gonna start myself by saying you all know me, but where's my position in terms of academia and precarity? Most of you know, and I've been very vocal, that I left academia after my PhD because I just couldn't see a way that I could combine a stable life and having kids and security in terms of money and having a mortgage with the current situation at universities and academia. And that was me. Now I'm going to throw the ball to one of the people you already know, Dr. Miranda Corcoran. Miranda, if you want to introduce yourself and tell us, where are you at on the precarity in academia spectrum?
Thank you. Thank you for having me back, and congratulations on 5 seasons as well. That's fantastic.
So
I'm currently a lecturer. And I always say currently whenever people ask for my job title for publications or for conferences and other things, because that's currently my situation, but it's probably not always going to be my situation. I'm currently coming to the end of a 3-year full-time lecturing position. Before that, I had a 2-year part-time lecturing position, and then a lot of post-grad tutoring, part-time teaching since about 2009. So that's currently where I am. I'm very close to the end of a contract at the moment, and a lot of things are up in the air. I have really no idea what's going to happen to me over the next few months. One of the things I'm looking into is doing a CELTA course so that I can teach English as a foreign language. My partner is Italian, and one of the things we're currently discussing is moving back to his region of Italy and maybe me doing some teaching. But honestly, I have no idea, which is, again, probably the situation of many people in precarious employment.
That's a tough choice. Pasta and pizza or precarity?
Yes, and cold Irish weather.
And the weather.
Rain.
And Miranda, I know from our conversations that we had in the past that you are being very nice about your current situation, because essentially what's happening with your contract now is that you're basically renewed on almost a monthly basis, isn't it?
Essentially, yeah. So after March, my contract is going to be on a month-to-month basis until maybe September. But again, I don't know, because all of it is contingent on funding. So yeah, it's a pretty crap situation, really, especially because, you know, obviously I really like my job. I really like being able to, you know, plan for my teaching and for my work with students and my supervision and stuff like that. But at the moment, I really have no idea. And I imagine that, you know, for the next couple of months, I'll have no idea.
Yeah, tough spot to be in. But thanks for the introduction. And we're kicking off like a very positive vibe today.
Very optimistic episode.
If we move on to our next brand new guest, Deirdre Flynn. Deirdre, welcome to the show. I'm so excited that you're here. Tell us a bit about yourself. Introduce yourself to the listeners. And where are you at on the precarity spectrum?
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me. And I'm so glad that this conversation is happening, because I think it needs to constantly happen over and over again until there is a change made. I'm 7 years post-PhD now. And over the last number, now I'm currently permanent. I'm really, really lucky. I'm one of the very, very few lucky people who have a permanent job. I was made permanent this year, or last year, in April. And but prior to that, I worked everywhere that I could get work, from hourly 2 hours a week contracts to 6 months to 4 months to 2 months to 3 months. And while putting together my contracts for a job that I was applying for. It turned out that I had worked 10 years of contracts in 5 years. While all during that time, like many of my other colleagues, I was earning much less than the living wage, going from job to job to job, you know, and as Miranda talks about, that insecurity, not knowing what's next, not knowing if you'll have a job in September, the constant kind of hustle, I think I call it, it's been shocking to me now that I don't have to hustle, that I, like, everything I've done for the past 7 years has been really strategic to get the next job. So it's something that's very close to my heart. I wrote an article about it that came out in May 2020 about being precarious. And I get an email, I would say once a month, from somebody still saying, this is my situation, this is my situation. I'm getting paid in book tokens to do lectures. I'm getting this, I'm getting that. I get it, I get contacted constantly from people who are going through this. We know that in Ireland, at the very minimum, there is 11,500 people on precarious contracts in academia. It's the only sector of the public service who was treated like this. And I think it's really, really important that change comes, and that because of the nature of the industry, that it has to come from people in secure positions.
Absolutely.
And that's my position.
Can you also tell us where you're teaching, what your research interests are, and maybe something that you like to do outside of academia to maybe, like, not bump us down too much?
So I teach in contemporary literature, and Irish studies and contemporary literature, and I'm teaching in Mary I in Limerick. I'm really, really lucky, and I love my job, I love my students, I love the work. I don't think anyone would do this if you didn't love it. And something about me that's outside of work, I'm here in my house at the moment, and which I rent, and there is my dog. And I think that's my outlet for everything. She's the joy there. She's a great helper and companion, and a major feature in all of my lectures when we had to teach from home. I had to stop many a lecture when a postman arrived at the door. But so she's a constant feature. But that's a little bit about me.
An emotional support animal for academia. I love that.
We should all have one.
Brilliant. We should all have one, absolutely. And our other guest on the show today, and brand new guest to the show, is Dr. Dara Downey. Dara, welcome to the show. So excited to have you. Tell us, where are you on the precarity spectrum, and anything else we should know about you?
Okay. I was kind of thinking, with me, it's not so much a spectrum as, like, you know, one of those twirly ice cream things with the spectrum running through it. And it's, yeah. So currently I have three employers. One of those is actually a full-time contract, which showed up in the middle of last term, but I had already committed to a whole bunch of other stuff. I actually had four employers before Christmas. I could have hung on to one of them this term if I didn't get that full-time contract, which runs from November until June. That full-time contract will be my third short-term full-time contract in that same place. I've also had another one in another university. So I finished my PhD in 2009. Since then, I had a two-year postdoc, a two-year full-time job, a nine-month job, a six-month job, and this, and in between various years in the wilderness. I was kind of thinking before this that I've got quite good at sort of working out what I need to buy when my contract is coming to an end. So I buy loads of clothes. I stock up on cosmetics so that I know that I have everything. I buy a whole pile of books, and then I just buy nothing for another year and a half. And then I have a contract and I buy loads of stuff, and then I buy nothing. So yeah, this is kind of how it's been, which means that I have an awful, awful, awful lot of sets of lecture slides that I've only used once. Particularly over the last 4 or 5 years, which is deeply frustrating. In fact, I inherited a lecture course from Deirdre last term, her dystopian lit module, which I really enjoyed, but I think I did too many books. Anyway, so it's been a swirly spectrum over the last couple of years, and I am incredibly lucky that I have a very lazy landlord who hasn't put the rent up since 2014.
I have to meet him to sign a new lease on Monday, and I'm not looking forward to that, because he had been talking about, you know, selling the place or whatever. And in my current situation, if I had to move right now, or if I had to pay a substantial amount more in rent, it wouldn't be great, because as everyone has been saying, it's really difficult to plan. You know, I suppose I was kind of also thinking before this, in some ways, maybe I've educated myself about a whole pile of new stuff over the last 4 or 5 years. I've, you know, probably have, I'd say I now have a more diverse teaching profile than lots of people who have permanent jobs. That's briefly a consolation, and a lot of the other time it really isn't. So yeah, outside of academia, I was actually racking my brains thinking, what am I actually interested in outside of academia? I watch an awful lot of supernatural and horror television, like a lot of it. Though sometimes that feels like work as well, because I'm an American literature scholar, but I'm also a Gothic person. And I always say that when I go to American lit conferences, I'm the only Gothic person. And when I go to Gothic conferences, I'm the only Americanist, which, yeah, I think sometimes our paths cross in these things and sometimes they don't. So, yeah. I guess that's kind of it. Is there anything else you want me to talk about?
No, that's all good. Thank you very much. And I suppose the first thing that I want us to talk about is kind of the idea that we had about academia before we got into it. What was that image that you guys had entering the academic world, starting your degrees? Did you know that you wanted a career in this? What were kind of the presets in your mind, I suppose, to academia, and were you aware of just how difficult it is to make it in academia? If I can just throw the question out there, Deirdre, do you want to go first?
Okay, so I was a journalist for a number of years and went back to become an academic. So I went back and did my MA and then did my PhD, and I was not aware. Both my parents wouldn't have college degrees. So I wouldn't, like, I'm the only person in my family with an MA, and then subsequently the only person with a PhD. But so I wasn't fully aware of what was necessary to do a PhD. So I was looking at, you know, the lecturers and thinking, okay, right, okay, they have a couple of publications, they have this, you know, some of them started while doing their PhDs and they became lecturers. So I thought, okay, you know, I go back, I do the 4 or 5 years, and I'd be in a really good position then to go and get a job. So I was really unaware of how difficult it would be, and how every year that I went, when I was going back, when I was doing my MA and PhD, the bar just kept on getting higher. So it was like, you needed some teaching. Oh no, they don't care about teaching. Then you need to have these publications. Oh no, you also need all of this funding. So I wasn't fully aware. And I do feel like sometimes that comes from the fact that I just didn't know, because of the, like, it wasn't in my family, it wasn't thing, it didn't look like it. And you're not really sure. They're, like, everyone would, like, you know, now I'm permanent and I can take PhD students on. I'm like, God, I want to, but I also want to be honest with you and say to you, no, you know, this is not going to get you a job, or 3% of all of them will get a job. But I do think there's also, like, there's a naivety that you have when you start out too, because it's something you really love, it's something you really enjoy, and you think, yeah, but I'll be the lucky one. Like, I'm forever the optimist, you know, in everything. I always think, yeah, no, it'll work out, it'll be fine. And that's set me up, I suppose, for so long to kind of go, it'll be next year. But I don't think I understood what it would be like. I didn't understand how competitive it was going to be. I didn't realize it was that, but it has changed so drastically in the last 10 to 15 years, that even, like, the supervisors and our senior colleagues, it's a lot different for this current generation and the people coming after than it was 10 or 15 years ago. You're going in now with, you're competing, you know, with people, like, as a junior, you might have 1 or 2 monographs, you have maybe 10 or 15 or 20 publications, you have funding behind you, you have all these teachers. But that wasn't what was necessary years ago. I do think that there was always this discussion around that rite of passage. You know, that it was like, okay, there's going to be difficult years. It's going to take a little while. And you think, okay, that's fine. But actually, that's not really how it is. That rite of passage has become the norm, right? So the norm is that this is how academia works, that people will be in precarious contracts for 10 to 20 to 30 years, because universities and institutions are depending on those styles of contracts now. So even if, you know, if you were thinking about what it was like 10 or 15 years ago to get into academia, it's not, because actually the landscape has changed so massively, and because of how there is no legislation around it, we are depending on the goodness of people who hold the purse strings to pay people correctly, and they look at their bottom line, you know. So that, like, the way it works is different than it worked 10 or 15 years ago. But I didn't realize that when I got into it. My eyes were not open to it. I didn't come from an industry like that. But I also came from the private sector. So I worked in the private sector for a very long period of time. And like, we were treated, you know, differently. And you always thought, God, the public sector, they're a lot better. They're treated a lot better. Things are a lot better in the public sector. And I was shocked when I started working at how people were treated. I couldn't believe that this was okay. I couldn't believe that I was that poor. I couldn't believe that I was that badly paid. I couldn't believe that I couldn't afford heating, that I couldn't afford the bus, that I couldn't afford lunch on certain days. I was afraid to meet people for coffee in case I had to pay for it. And that I couldn't believe that, because Dara was talking about her rent there. And I remember my rent went up in 2017, and it went up by 70%. And she said to me, but you're a lecturer. And I was thinking, I'm earning 16,000 euros a year before tax. You know, that's more than, that's less than what you're asking me to pay in rent. You know what I mean? I couldn't understand it. I was looking at them going, but that's, you know, everyone thinks it, and we don't talk about it. And it's nearly like, you shouldn't talk about it. You shouldn't talk about that you're poor. You shouldn't talk that you can't afford this conference. You shouldn't talk that you haven't been paid for that lecture. You shouldn't talk about these things. And like, because I worked in the private sector, if I didn't get paid for something, I asked and I spoke up about it. And like, I remember not getting paid for work that I did. It was March and I had done the hours in November. And I remember going in going, I don't care that this is embarrassing to say that I can't pay my rent and I'm hungry, but that's what I'm going to say to this person in finance, because you need to pay me for this work, because I am dependent on this, or I will lose my house, or I will have to ask, you know, somebody for money to help me pay my rent. It shocked me that it just was kind of like, no, stay quiet about it. It's okay. And if you stay and hang on, you'll eventually be rewarded. But that's not the case. And my position and the fact that I'm permanent is not the case for everybody. I am exceptionally lucky because, and I've talked about this before, and it's something that Teresa O'Keefe and others talk about, Paula Tumulty and you know, the Fitzsimons and Maynooth and stuff, and Gerry O'Neill, they're talking about the precarity penalty that comes along with it. And we mentioned this in the email, is that the longer you're precarious, you know what I mean, the more you are precarious, because your CV can't have those things. Your CV can't have the funding, because you're not long term in a college to get it. You can't have supervision experience because your contract isn't long enough to allow you to supervise. You can't have, you do so much teaching, and Dara says that, like, I can teach from neoclassical poetry to, you know, to Japanese literature. I've lecture slides and everything, and I've taught on all of these things. But you're putting them new modules together all the time, and it takes hours and hours of research and work, and then figuring out a new system and doing all this. And then you have to write all these articles and God, put together a monograph or do any of these things while doing all of this new work, but you don't get the time to do it because you're doing so much work. So your CV is going to be different. And God forbid you have caring responsibilities, you have illness, you have a disability, you don't have a partner at home with some money, that you have to pay rent, that your rent goes up, that you need to drive.
Or you want to have a child.
Jesus, you have a health emergency, you want to have a child. You can't, like, and they're on top of that, like, the baby penalty is so real in the States, you know, that the majority of women who are in permanent positions in the States do not have children. And if they do, they are more likely to leave academia. Yeah. So, like, I don't know where I was going with this, but it drives me crazy. It's so badly organized. And the expectation is that people will continue to come out of PhDs, do this work. And, you know, as enthusiastic as you were, because people say to you when you come out of your PhD, you know, when you want to teach that, you're like, yes, 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 yes. And until you realize you're not getting paid or that you're being exploited or you're doing this work, you know, and suddenly it's 6 years later and you're still doing the same thing. And then you get burnt out, you leave, and then somebody else comes in and takes that position. And it's just devalues the work that we do, it devalues the research we do, it devalues the education that we have, it devalues the students, it devalues the courses, it devalues the humanities. So yeah, it just, I could go on all day, and I tend to. But I think it's a scourge.
And speaking to these expectations versus reality that we were just talking about, not just for ourselves, but I distinctly remember in 2019, I talk about this conference almost every episode, the 2019 IGA Gothic International Conference. And I actually was traveling with my best friend from primary school, and he's a software engineer. So he is very highly paid. He had just taken a 6 month leave just to travel the world. He was working part time, and he joined me for the conference because he was remotely interested. He wanted to sit in on a couple of papers, and he just wanted to see what kind of the dynamic is like. And he sat in with us, you know, in these like university halls, having dinners, having breakfast, talking about our research, but also sharing, oh, you know, I'm on an hourly occasional contract, I'm on a 0-hour contract, like I barely scraped the money together to come over here to do all of this. And towards the end of the conference, he tells me, I did not know that this is what all of you are going through. This is not what it looks like from the outside. Why are you putting yourself through this? And there's like this weird dichotomy between this idealistic, we all love the research, we love the teaching, we love the publishing, right? But everything else, the system that's around it, is just so awful that there's no way for us to properly function in this space, right? And I think, Dara, you were talking about this as well, with like all the different contracts that you have going on at the moment, right? Is there, maybe we can unpack a couple of these contracts so that people get a better idea of the kind of stuff that we're dealing with. Dara, if you just want to tell us a bit more about the contracts that you're currently on.
Okay. That's a good point. I mean, just, yeah, maybe before I start, one thing that if there's anyone listening to this who doesn't know much about how academia works, I really want to stress that the very fact that I am working like this means there's plenty of work. You know, I think sometimes we get really patronizing people who are like, why do you stick in this sector if there's no work? There's loads of bloody work. There's just no commitment to spending money on people for the whole of their professional lives. I turned down work this year. So, right. So my most stable employment is I teach effectively 1 hour a week in the Trinity Access program, which is effectively the thing that kept me in academia. I was on the verge of applying for the civil service. In fact, I did. And then I kind of gave up because it wasn't great. Anyway, you know, I was thinking about all kinds of things. I've trained as a life coach because I needed a plan B. I do loads of proofreading and stuff, but a couple of years ago, so I had a 9-month contract in Maynooth, which came to an end. It was the second time that I had to reapply for my own job, and I was replaced by someone who I know and like, but that doesn't make it any better. like at all. I'm friends with both of those people who replaced me, but it's still funny sometimes. But yeah, so I had to interview for a 1 hour teaching a week gig in the Trinity Access program. The only reason why I stuck with it is because it's just so incredibly rewarding. You actually see the results of your teaching. People go on to, you know, become undergrads in English or in other things in Trinity, and it's really, really great. You get paid a flat rate for the year, and that includes meetings and marking and stuff. You never have an awful lot of students, so it's like, it's kind of onerous in terms of the pastoral care element of it, but in terms of the actual teaching, it's fine. Like, it's actually grand. So that's been the thing that since I think maybe 2017 has been like my most stable form of employment. I, like an idiot, gave it up for 6 months between January and June in 2019. Actually, it was, so I had a full-time contract in UCD for those 6 months, which is what paid for me to go to the IGA. I was like, this is my last hurrah. I'm spending all my money to go to Chicago. Whee! And then I was very poor when I got back, which was really silly. But anyway, so yeah, so I've had that, but I gave it up for 6 months, which means that even though I've been doing the Access Program stuff for a long time, it's only in September that I'm going to be entitled to a contract of indefinite duration, because I broke it for 6 months, which was really silly. But at the time, yeah, it wouldn't have worked juggling, but I'm juggling now because I'm not falling into that trap again. So then the other thing that I'm doing is I teach on the Open Education Program in DCU. So that's kind of an evening and weekend gig. It's like, it's slightly odd. It's this course called Lit One, which is like Introduction to English Literature. And you have the students for like an hour and a half, 12 or 13 times a year, on like different days of the week or on weekends or whatever. They're mainly adult learners. And this is my second year doing that. DCU, you know, the like the teaching hour by hour. Oh, I just remembered I have to apply for, right, okay, I missed the deadline for claiming for my DCU hour. Okay, grand. Anyway, let's forget about that. Yeah, the amount of time that we have to put into claiming our hours is just exhausting, and it's different systems in different places, different deadlines. Anyway, that's the end of that. But so yeah, it doesn't pay that well, kind of, you know, the hourly rate is fine, but they have this amazing thing that they do at the end of the year where they give you what they call hilariously headage. So however many of your students, I know it's awful, they shouldn't call it that, but however many of them make it to the second essay of the year, you get paid a certain rate per student to account for like you doing the admin, emailing them and all the rest of it. Which means that there's a point in the summer where you just get these amazing lump sums. They pay you as well a certain amount of kind of, again, admin time on top of that, which is another flat rate. So DCU was something that, again, I'm really sticking with. It's like, it's been a really good thing. So before Christmas then, I ended up, I got Deirdre's Dystopian Lit first year UCD module, which, yeah, I really enjoyed. That was a bizarre 1.5 hour slot in the hottest room I have ever been in my entire life in a pandemic. It was disgusting. One of my students told me that she used to go back to her dorm or whatever and change into summer clothes before my class because it was so hot. It was gross. Anyway, amazingly, I didn't get sick. I don't know how that happened. And I also had a couple of tutorials as well, teaching horror film, which was so good in UCD. So I really enjoyed that. In the middle of it, one of the people who got made permanent when I got let go managed to get some teaching buyout because she's having childcare issues. And so, again, I applied. I had to interview. They hired me because they wanted to hire me. This is, you know, the second or third time that this has happened in the same university, just like over and over again. So I now have money, not an awful lot of money because it was a flat rate for this. So I wasn't on a scale. So it's a lot less than the last short term contract I had in the same place. But, you know, I'm putting up with it. And so I kept DCU and I kept Trinity so that I would have them again next year. But the other thing that I had before Christmas was the other person who got my Maynooth job. Also, she got an extra role. She needed teaching buyout, so I covered her Introduction to American Lit in Maynooth, and there was a point where I would have to get to Maynooth for 10 o'clock to give a single lecture, get back into town, go to my flat, sort myself out, go out to UCD for Deirdre's lecture, and then there was at least one or two nights when I had to then come home and have my DCU class for an hour and a half in the evening at 8 o'clock. So I had some stupid Tuesdays there for a while. But essentially, I will have the Trinity Access Programme next year. That's definitely happening. DCU, they're sort of trying to dismantle the open education unit at the moment. They're trying to get the full-time staff in DCU to do the work of what a whole lot of tutors have been doing for a very long time. Probably looks like they're not going to make that change for September, but they really want to. We keep having all these meetings where they say things like, it's very early in the process, so it's happening in September. It's like, those two things don't match up. That's not early in the process. That's a done deal. So yeah, I mean, I'm kind of at the coalface of all of this, and it's not much fun. But at the same time, I mean, I also get bits of like proofreading work. I'm bizarrely doing some proofreading for my doctor's wife at the moment, which is very strange, but it's the kind of thing that happens. It meant he got me a PCR test really quickly because I was like, I can't do her work if I'm worried about having COVID. So yeah, that was kind of good.
It's mind-boggling all the different areas that we need to stretch into in order to be able to scrape together the hours that we need. And one of the things that you just mentioned, Dara, that also happened, I suppose, to all of us, and especially like when I was doing my PhD, these hourly occasional contracts, and nobody is paying any attention to the planning of the class, the admin work that comes with it, and also the marking that comes with it then. And God forbid there's an issue with the students that needs addressing. In one of my first year classes, we had an issue in group work, and we had a mature student who overstepped with very young female students. And there was a lot of stuff to deal with on, you know, a level or two levels above my pay grade. And I still had to deal with it. Wasn't getting paid for it. Didn't have the training for it, needless to say. But this also, like, is all added up. And Miranda, I know what Dara is going through with someone replaced her, someone she knew replaced her for a permanent position. You're facing something similar at the moment with your contract coming to an end, or maybe not getting extended, maybe getting extended, maybe getting turned into a permanent position. So can you tell us a bit more about that and how you're dealing with the insecurity?
Well, initially I was dealing with the insecurity by crying a lot. But so yeah, I mean, I'm kind of in a weird situation, like I said, where I've literally no clue what's happening at the moment. I've definitely been there with the hourly occasional contracts while I was a PhD student. I worked in my department teaching. I worked in an admin office. I did some work with our access program. So I kind of cobbled everything together, you know, sort of into a pile that was kind of sustainable in terms of money and stuff. But at the moment, I think, I mean, one thing I do have to say is that I'm not in a situation where someone will be replacing me, because it doesn't look like there is anyone to replace me. So it's a bad situation.
You are irreplaceable.
Well, no, just like there is literally no one. The problem is that they will not be advertising the job again. If that looks like that's the situation it's going to be at the moment, that they're just not going to be renewing the post. So it's not a great situation for me, obviously, but it's also not a great situation for the department, in that we're already, like so many humanities departments, understaffed, both in terms of teaching and in terms of admin work. So if my post goes, if I go, it looks like there won't be anyone in that post at all, because universities just aren't, and, you know, the government as a whole just aren't funding the humanities. So it, you know, it really looks like there is just going to be nothing there. So yeah, it's kind of a weird, it's definitely a weird situation. I mean, I knew that my contract was coming to an end. Like I said, I was in a 2-year part-time contract teaching here, filling in for people who are on leave. Then I was in a 3-year full-time contract. I was in a post that was created because some of our staff members moved to a different department because of some reorganization. So my post was created to fill that void. I've been lecturing here for like 5 years. And I mean, aside from the sort of general terror about what's going to happen to me in terms of like paying for things and being able to afford rent, I mean, I have a lease that needs to be renewed in July. And I'm like, do I re-sign my lease? What do I do in July? You know, do I re-sign my lease? What exactly am I going to do? So aside from that stuff, I mean, there's also just, you know, I'm kind of thinking about like, what happens with my courses? Should I be planning my courses for next year? Because obviously that's something you need to start on early. I teach one course that's called Special Topics for our BA students, where we get guest speakers to come in and talk to them. And that's something that, you know, you have to start planning very early, like May or June. And I'm like, do I plan that? I co-supervise PhD students, which I think might be a bit of an anomaly because I don't have a permanent contract, but I do co-supervise PhD students. And I'm like, what happens with them? And like, they know the situation, they know the position I'm in, and they know that if I go, we're going to have to get another staff member to fill in for me as a co-supervisor. I usually supervise MA students on some of the master's programs here as well. I don't know what the situation with that is. It looks like I probably can supervise because more than likely I'll be here until September. But again, that's not 100% certain. So like I said, my initial kind of response, I mean, I knew that my contract was coming to an end, but there had been lots of talk about the post being re-advertised and me being able to reapply for that. And then I was like, I would have some certainty because if I reapplied and I got it, I could stay here. If I reapplied and I didn't get it, my plan was to move to Italy with my partner and just give up on the whole academia thing and, you know, do some language teaching. So I kind of had an either or situation, but now I don't really have that anymore because I have no idea what's happening. So I'm kind of dealing with at the moment. One of the ways I was dealing with it was by applying for a CELTA course so that I could teach English as a foreign language if I had to move abroad. And I noticed this is a kind of a recurring theme with people here. Everyone has a backup plan. No one can feel like they're 100% committed to their job and to their career because your job isn't committed to you. And as Dara said, it's not that there isn't work. There's loads of work. There's tons. We're totally understaffed in my department, as many departments are, but it's that universities and the people who hold the purse strings are not committing to permanency for people. They're not committing to security for people. And my department itself is great. Like, I feel really lucky in that I like everyone I work with. Everyone is so nice. My students are great. But there is also a sense of, I don't know, almost like not necessarily betrayal, but there's a sense of frustration or unfairness in that university management isn't, not just here, but everywhere, just seems unwilling to provide people who have worked for their institutions for years, sometimes decades, with some basic level of security so that they can, you know, perhaps own a house or start a family or not have to worry about, you know, being able to eat or, you know, heat their homes. You know, it's just, yeah. So I don't know. I think a little bit like Deirdre's situation, because I did sort of want to jump on that when she was talking about her own background and how that shaped her expectations. I was the first person in my family to go to college. I was the first person in my family to like sit the leaving cert and finish secondary school. And so I had no idea about academic culture or what it was like. When I talk to my extended family about what I do for a living, I just say I'm a teacher because they don't really get what being a lecturer is. So I had no idea of anything. I just kind of assumed that if I went to college and worked hard and got a degree, I would be able to get a job. And if I worked really hard and got a PhD, I would be able to have something resembling financial security. And that was kind of the narrative that I was given when I was in school. I was kind of, you know, I was very much sort of told that, you know, if you're smart and if you work hard, you could have a better standard of living, especially coming from a working class background. I was very much told you could have a better standard of living than those who came before you if you work hard, if you go to college, if you do well. But to be honest, like, I was talking to my mother about this recently, and she was talking about, like, her experiences, you know, she doesn't work at the moment, but, like, you know, when she was younger, she worked in factories, and she worked as a cleaner and things like that. And I was talking about the fact that my mum actually had more job security in those roles than I do in academia. So it just, yeah, it kind of sculptures that narrative. And there's something very, I don't know, disappointing. I think there's a sense of disillusionment that, you know, that narrative that you're fed about, you know, working hard. But yeah, so there's that kind of general sense of frustration and just kind of general disappointment. And I don't know.
Miranda, I think one of the things that I've always thought is that there's a gentrification of the role. So that if you're wealthy and if you're okay to sustain things, it's easier to stay in this job.
Oh, I totally agree with you on that.
There's a gatekeeping, isn't there?
There is. I actually threw that into our chat, this question of like finances and class in academia and how that impacts how you, the extent to which you can successfully navigate precarity. Because certainly if you come from a wealthier background, if you have familial support, or if you have a partner who has money or who can support you financially, you are much better suited to dealing with the uncertainty of a 1-year contract and then a 6-month contract and then a few months of unemployment and then another 2-year contract. You know, you're much better able to navigate that if you have financial support. And I think it is a lot harder for people who don't have that. Like, so one of my favorite recent stories is that I was talking to an older academic, and this person is really, really nice. It's not someone I work with. It's someone who works in an international university. So, you know, it's not anyone from my department. But I was talking to this older academic, and they kind of made me feel like I wasn't playing the game correctly. Like, I was talking about how difficult my current situation was, how I would like to have a permanent contract, not just for my own security, but because I love what I do here. I love the students I have here. So I was talking about that. And they sort of made me feel as if I wasn't playing the game. And they were talking about how when they'd finished their PhD at an American university, they had like a 3-year teaching contract. And then when that was up, they got a research position in Germany. And then when that was up, they got another research position in France or something. And they were talking about like how exciting that was. And this was a long time ago. So this would have been like the 80s or something. So there wasn't quite the same issue with precarity that there is now.
Back in the day when you needed one publication to get senior lectureship.
But they sort of made me feel as if I wasn't like, I wasn't playing fair, or I wasn't playing the game by being frustrated with precarity. And they talked about how exciting the movement between contracts was for them. But I later found out from a mutual friend that this person comes from a really wealthy background. So like, of course, constant moving around. Of course, the idea of having a 2-year contract and then a 1-year contract was exciting for them, because they didn't have to worry about like falling into poverty between contracts. So like, there is, I think, a lot of privilege. And even though we like to pretend that academia has evolved to a point where people from all backgrounds can succeed in the field, there is a level of security that people who come from wealth and privilege have that many of the rest of us do not have. And therefore, they are the people who are more likely to stay and thrive and succeed in academia. Whereas many of us who do not have that kind of privilege are just going to be like, you know what, I can't live like this.
I think as well, I was thinking about it there, and I'm thinking about all the different types of contracts, and I was saying about the numbers, and that like approximately 50% of all undergraduate teaching in Ireland is provided by people on precarious contracts. And those precarious contracts range from the hourly contract. And when we say an hourly contract, I think like it's really important to kind of, I suppose everyone's going to be listening to this is probably in academia and knows, but the hourly contract is what can be referred to as a lecturing hour, which includes all your prep. So the rule of thumb, which is written nowhere, I found out, is that you do 3 hours of prep for 1 hour of lecture. But then that lecturing hour also includes any meetings with students, meetings with your department, meeting with admin staff, meeting with management, meetings with anything, any emails throughout the term, any training that you need to do is all included within that rate. Because I know one of the things that comes out is that people will say, oh God, the hourly rate is great. And But the hourly rate is a rate for, say, covering 4 to 5 hours. So really it's down at minimum pay and under minimum wage. And that's the hourly contract. The other ones are the fixed terms. And what Miranda is on, and some of the ones that you have, Dara, they're fixed purpose, fixed term. So they're at a specific, for a specific point. So the staff are needed. And that's exactly it. The jobs are there. So they need people to teach these courses. They need people to do this work. And they bring in people and they'll say, it's a fixed term, fixed purpose, specific thing, contract. So you can't, you have no entitlements on it. And you can't, you know, if you get sick or you get pregnant or you get any of the things, you can't have any of it. It's, that's it. And once it's over, it's over. It doesn't count towards your pension, doesn't count towards anything. And they depend on that. And it, and like, while we can blame university management and we can blame departments, or we can blame, because it's like everywhere I've gone and everywhere I worked, and even within institutions, different departments had different policies on how they did these things, depending on how, where they were of your situation. The book stops with the legislation. Nobody's going to do anything about this unless we have legislation on it, because it's really cheap labor. You know, that you could get somebody in who's so specialized to teach, to do, you know, 40 to 60 hours a week and be paying them, you know, €1,000 a month. And like, and then for 12 weeks, and then let them go once the term is over and send them off to the Dole office. And it's unless the legislation comes in and recognizes the fact that colleges are dependent on this labour, and then hugely dependent on this labour to provide one of the main purposes of the university, to teach, that it won't change, because it's so cheap. The labour, like, it is, I'm thinking, you know, like, there are people, when I was on my less contracts, when I was earning less than 20 grand a year and maybe working in 2 and 3 institutions, there were people getting paid 3 and 4 and 5 times my income working alongside me. And like, so there's a huge discrepancy there, but it's so cheap. And they were also entitled to sick pay and pensions and all of these extra things on top of it. So like, the money saving is massive for the university. And like, I used to find it, like, I would, you know, be there in class and you'd be thinking, this student has paid more in fees that I am getting to teach them and to work with them. You know, I, you know, today they are getting, they're paying more than I earn, you know, and I couldn't believe that that was the case, because of that attitude, as you say, that it's, the attitude is that, you know, we're well paid, and if you're permanent, yes. And that's the job at the end. Like, it's a permanent job, is a well paid, secure, public sector job, but we work hard for it. And the education of our students is exceptionally paramount, and it's so important. And we can't devalue that, but we have to make sure that it is, it's via legislation. And I think that, like, it's, you know, like, we can't, yeah, I can give out as much about university management or about HR, but like, they will, you know, they're just going to say, well, this is what the legislation tells me, these are what I have to do, this is the contract. And I can't depend on them to think that I should be nice to this person, you know, when it's cheaper for them to pay them less money and cheaper to get rid of them. And like, in your situation, Miranda, like, if you're in that job for a specific period of time, for 3 years, it's over if you've been in a job role for 2 years, and it's a new role and it's all of these things, you're entitled to a contract of indefinite duration. But the way they write the contracts, the way they do the things, they ensure that you're not entitled to those things. So they know they need the workers, and they use the legislation that's in place currently to make sure that they can keep us cheap and keep the labor really, really cheap.
That's one of the things that has changed over the last 10 years. You know, like, when I got into all of this, I finished my PhD just as the crash happened. Then I got a 2-year postdoc and I was like, I'm doing this right. Then I had a year and a half in the wilderness. Then I got a full-time job. And, you know, as Miranda was saying, people from the previous generation, for them, if you got that kind of full-time job, they would keep you. They would, you know, it might take a little while. You might have to reapply once or twice, but you got kept, which means that they don't understand that the upshot of that legislation, which was supposed to protect us, has actually meant that HR departments are getting more careful about, like you say, putting in the, I keep wanting to call it probable cause, objective grounds, that's it. It sounds like probable cause for whatever reason in my head, I can't get them disentangled. Too much police procedural stuff, but yeah, that they make sure that if you do get a little bit of work, they can easily replace you with a mysterious stranger who is always going to be cooler than you, always. Or, you know, in your case, Miranda.
Which, you know, again, it leaves me in a bad position, but it leaves everyone I work with in a bad position. It leaves my students in a bad position. And like, that's the thing about precarity as well. It doesn't just damage people who are precarious. It creates bad working conditions for everyone in the department. It creates uncertainty for students. Like, it's, you know, it's bad for everyone.
And it's something that struck me as well coming into the English speaking system, so to say, because I did my undergrads in Germany. I didn't pay any student fees. I completed 2 undergrads, could have gone on to do the master's, the PhD, and not pay a single thing. And coming from this publicly funded university system, I was used to seminars with like 50, 60 people. I was used to lectures that were held in cinemas because there were just so many students. And I knew the departments were understaffed. I knew all of that. But coming into the English speaking system, going to England and then to Ireland, in my head, just having this aspect of, I'm paying for my education, so there will be a payoff in terms of, yes, smaller class sizes, but there will also be no staffing issues. There will be none of these issues because, and I'm just thinking back to the UCC's University College Cork's president giving a lovely little interview about how he thinks the undergrad education should be even more expensive. And where is the, you know, there's difference between what we're paying when we're students and then now seeing it from the other side as staff, where does all that money go? And it's also knowing from a couple of people I know in science, they get paid for their PhDs, they get these like full-time positions, they get all these like extra bonuses and all of this. And it's just like, where does the money go? But then also, what does that do to our heads? And how are we logically explaining to ourselves why we're putting ourselves through this? And I'm the only one who's left the madhouse, right? And I'm still feeling guilty and I still feel like I didn't achieve what I set out to achieve and that I gave up. I have colleagues who started the PhD with me who are proceeding to do the postdoc, who have the family money, who don't want to have kids, who just have different priorities. And that research is amazing and I would love to do what they're doing right now. But there's this part of me that restructured, you know, priorities and was like, okay, so I'd rather have kids. I'd rather have this more or less stable life. But there's a part of me that thinks I didn't make it to the end of the video game because I wasn't strong enough to do it.
I very nearly did leave. I mean, I might be leaving again. I might be leaving to teach English as a foreign language or do something else. Like, one of the other things I do on occasion is I write for, DVD booklets, and I do DVD commentaries and I get some money from that. And like, I know people who've kind of parlayed that into like full-time content writing and stuff like that. And like, that's another option. But like, I very nearly, so I might be leaving again, but I also very nearly left after my PhD, because I worked in admin for 4 years during my PhD and then for a year after my PhD in my university in one of the student support services. And I had applied for what's called like a panel, whereby I'm sure a lot of you know this, but like maybe for listeners who don't, certainly in my university anyway, for like a lot of admin jobs, what they do is they like establish a panel of qualified people who can then be like drawn upon for vacancies that become available. So I'd applied for the admin panel in my university, and it just so happens that around the same, and I had also just gotten a job offer to teach English as a foreign language in the Middle East. So I had all of these things up in the air, and then a position became available in my department, an academic position, because 2 other staff members got a teaching buyout and they were looking for someone to fill in for that. And they had interviews and I got the position, and that's what kind of got me to stay. But like, I had one foot out the door. And again, people are, you know, I'm sure there are people there going, listening, going, oh, you're not committed because, you know, you were planning to go teach English as a foreign language. You were planning to do admin work.
It's considered something less.
It is, but also like, you kind of need your backup plan. Like even Dara was talking about proofreading and life coaching. You need a backup plan because there is no stability. There is no security. Like this time next year, I could need to be in a completely different field because, you know, my post might have vanished, you know? So I was very close to leaving as well. And one of the reasons I was, you know, very much planning to leave was because of just how bleak academia looked to me, like how bleak my future looked. Because people now are definitely, and I think we've talked about this before, people like postgrads and postdocs and early career researchers now are talking very openly, I think, about precarity and the damage done by precarity and how unfair it often is and about exploitative labor practices and things like that. But when I was a PhD, I started my PhD in 2009 and I was kind of working and stuff. So I finished it in 2015. But when I started my PhD, people were very accepting of that culture. People were like, oh yeah, you know, I'll finish here and then I'll do a 2-year postdoc and then I'll do a 1-year contract here and then I'll do a 2-year contract here. And people were just accepting of the fact that, you know, you might need to spend a decade or so being precarious. Whereas now people are talking about it a little bit more and people are highlighting kind of the inequities in the system and some of the ways in which people are exploited. But like I very nearly left as well because I was thinking, what kind of future do I have here? What kind of life is it living on these, you know, temporary contracts, never having any kind of security? And like security is such a basic thing. And sometimes I'm kind of afraid to say that like job security is a basic thing because it makes me sound, I feel like I sound selfish or I sound greedy saying I want job security, considering how many, you know, ECORs, how many early career academics are in these temporary contracts. And I think, am I being selfish? But like,
and that's part of the academic culture that we keep ourselves down and try to rationalize we don't have money. And
exactly,
that's the idealistic thing that we should strive towards. We suffer for our research and for our students, and anything else, any kind of security is like,
but like obviously like it's not selfish to want to maybe own a home someday, to want to maybe start a family someday. Like something I think about, like recently I was talking to someone and they were like, oh, you're probably not really worried about like pensions and stuff because you're only in your 30s. But I'm like, yeah, but the way things are going, I'll someday be in my 50s and I still won't have like a pension entitlement. I'll be in my 60s and I won't have a pension entitlement. I was thinking recently about a colleague who took sick leave and like someone was brought in to replace them, but it was temporarily and their job was waiting for them when they came back. And sometimes I think, what if I got sick? You know, what would happen if I got sick? I mean, okay, I'm in my 30s, but people do get ill. Like, what would happen? What if I needed to take time off for like medical treatment or something? What would happen to me? Because I don't have those supports. I don't have those, you know, those fail safes.
I thought about that. Before COVID, so in 2019, I was working in Limerick and in Dublin and covering for 2 full-time people who were off. And I had part-time and hourly contracts and I got sick and I lost my voice. But if I didn't go to work, I wouldn't get paid because I was hourly. So I remember going in and like not talking that entire day. And there was a microphone in the class. And I remember the audible gasp at the sound of my voice as I spoke and did my lecture to like 120 people, because I needed the money to do it because I couldn't take that time off because I just wouldn't get paid. And then getting on the train and taking the 3.5 hours to go to work in Dublin the next day with the same bloody voice. I was like, oh my God, like that was wild that I would do it. Like thinking, you know, and now you shouldn't go into work if you're sick or whatever. But I just think like those things, those basic things that you do because you need to get paid. You need to pay the rent. You're hungry. You're all of those things. Like I do think that there is that sense that like, you know, like that I like I'm really lucky and I'm really aware of how lucky I am. I know that only 3% of people who have PhDs will go on and get a job, and I think it's only 5% of postdocs. I didn't have a postdoc. All of my jobs that I took were short-term or hourly. And like, I feel like because I was in the private sector and because I was a journalist, that I had a different way of networking and doing things, that I was, you know, really hustling for the job all the time. And, you know, I'd be asking people if they had hours in September. I'd be saying, oh, is there anything coming up? You know, I was asking people constantly about jobs and hassling people for jobs to do, you know, and you were like, because I had the time to do that, because I didn't have caring responses, because I was in the full of my health, because, you know, I had been outside of work for a period of time, outside of academia, I had a different approach to it. But like, it's not easy. And I don't know, Dara, like, I feel like I'm just really stubborn, do you know? Like, I feel like so much of it, like, why would I put myself through 60 and 70 hours a week? Why would I do these things? And like, it's really stubborn, but it's also because I have the privilege to do that. I was really lucky that I could. And like, it again feeds back into that gentrification thing, but it means that women, it means that people with any sort of caring responsibilities, it means that, you know, anybody that has any mental health issues, that anyone has an illness, that anyone of that doesn't isn't possibly from Ireland and doesn't know the culture, or might have, you know, additional it might be international, or might have a different ethnicity, might have a different sexuality, all of those are barriers. Like, I'm a white heterosexual woman, do you know, like, who's healthy. Like, Jesus, I'm so lucky. And that's one of the reasons, and I've no caring responsibilities, and that's one of the reasons. And I remember during the work, my partner's mother died, and she had no money, and we had to pay for a funeral. He's an only child, and I remember thinking at the time, because we found out that if you have money in the credit union, you'll get a grant towards a funeral. And I remember thinking, I must make sure I have enough money in the credit union for a grant towards my funeral, because that's how little money we had. And I remember thinking, this is just horrific that I put myself through this, you know, that we do these things. But I think, like, I think it's great to hear people talk more about it, because, like, I was everywhere I went, we had the kind of small conversations. I don't remember, when I was in UCD, I remember Derry would go into my office, and like, there was a group of us that would meet up and we'd have tea, and if we, any of us had any bars or anything we could share, we would talk about it. But it was the same in Galway, it was the same in Limerick, it was the same in Newell, it was the same everywhere I went. There were these conversations happening, and like, you kind of are told, don't mention it, don't talk about it too much, you don't want to get a name, and you don't want to be seen as a troublemaker, and like, you know, you're getting, but I'm so glad to see groups like in, say, like in Galway, the Postgrad Workers Alliance, the Workers Alliance in UCD, there's groups forming, and like, there is movements underfoot about this. Dara knows I'm involved in something myself, and Dara's involved with it too, and there's a couple of others, and like, I'm talking to the unions as well, and like, I think it has to be an umbrella group that brings this together, because this is an issue not just in universities, it's in ITs, it's in all sorts of third level institutions of all kinds, and it is endemic across the board. And I think these small groups are great because they're getting people talking about it and getting people discussing it. And I think now there needs to be a national umbrella group coming together that gets the government discussing these ideas and talking about it and getting the transparency out there of how many departments and how many universities are dependent on these people, because the numbers are hidden. They are, you know, universities are hiding them. The Cush report that came out in 2000 and whatever, you know, said, oh, we need something on these hourly paid people. these numbers and this dependency is hidden. As we said, the noteworthy report by Maria Delaney in the journal was excellent. But like, as she said, this is all she could find, and this is all that she could get from the institutions that replied to her, from her research, was 11,200. It doesn't include my institution. It doesn't include every institution. It doesn't include every part-time staff. So there are thousands of people out there in this situation. And I think that there is a sense that it needs to be organized, and each of us are isolated and been told to be quiet, and, you know, maybe you'll get... But actually, if we got a clear picture and we got to government with this, I think it would change, because it doesn't exist anywhere else in the university system. It's just at this level. It's okay, because you're a lecturer. You can be, you know, exploited, and, you know, it's not right. Anyway, there you go.
I was thinking about this lobby aspect earlier, because we as humanities scholars, we don't have the lobby, we don't have the money and the punch behind us that other industries, that other areas of research would have, right? And I feel like if we're coming towards the end of the discussion, maybe there's a silver lining at the horizon. With this aspect of, we talk about it more, things like your article, Deirdre, or maybe this episode, or if we just keep raising the awareness of, there is a way, if we all come together and we all talk about it and we all realize that we are in the same boat and that there's so many of us that we do have the power to eventually change something, that this could look different in... Maybe we won't see it anymore. I definitely won't. But maybe there is hope. Maybe like a light at the end of the tunnel that's not a train. And maybe Deirdre and Dara, I know we're focusing on Ireland here because we're all kind of working in Ireland. But of course, we also have a lot of international listeners. Is there maybe a couple of resources that you guys have in mind that you can recommend, where people can find out more about that kind of stuff, where people can, you know, like, how can we approach a conversation like this and just raise the awareness so that people go away with something like, oh, you know, I want to do something about it. Here's where I go to. And then I have one final question after that one. Dara, if you want to go first.
Okay, I have to admit, I don't know anything practical, but the thing that really wanted to say, that just if everyone could Google this at some point, a friend of mine sent me this Twitter thread a few years ago, and it was by this not very nice academic man, but my God, he made a good point. So there was this economist in the 70s called Baumol, Baumol, right? And he has this thing that he calls Baumol's cost disease. And essentially he was, you know, he was an economist or whatever, and he was looking around and he was very confused by the way that, say, musicians or nurses were paid. Because musicians in particular, you know, you get a couple of superstars at the top who are earning ridiculous amounts of money, and then you get this like underclass of people who aren't earning anything at all. And so he spent a bit of time thinking about it. And the thing that he eventually worked out, which makes so much sense to me, is that there are some industries where you literally cannot get more productive. Like, you can't teach faster. They tried having those MOOCs, no one liked them. They were terrible, you know. You can only teach at a certain rate, which means that you cannot become more productive, which is the only reason why we are seen as not being economically viable. There's nothing crap about being a lecturer. There's nothing crap about being in the humanities. It's just that you can't keep up with inflation. And so the only way to deal with that is to pay the superstars vast amounts of money to bring them in order to keep up with inflation, and then to have this massive underclass of people underneath it. And the point where this really started to click with me was, like, I'm on a couple of kind of groups and stuff on Facebook, and I started learning about workload allocation models, particularly in England. And, you know, we were kind of talking about this earlier, but like, what really shocked me was that when you have a full-time job, if you get one of these workload allocation models, it's quite clear that they actually still think that you can mark 50 essays in an hour. They still think that, you know, 3 hours prep for a new lecture is fine, which essentially means that for all academics, permanent or not, your teaching has been devalued because it is seen as something that does not keep pace with inflation at all. So this is bad for everyone. And like, the thing that I really realized when I was in my job in UCD was that the job is not the teaching. The job is the admin, and the job is bringing in a whole pile of research funding. And this is how the whole system works, which essentially means that, like, you know, Deirdre, I'm really hoping that things are going to get so crap in the future that so much of the teaching is going to be done by people like us, and so much of the, like, swanning around and schmoozing is going to be done by the increasingly small number of superstars at the very, very top. And our job, I think, is to tell people about this, to tell people that, you know, as Deirdre says, teaching and research is meant to be the main business of a university. They're paying less and less for teaching, and they're outsourcing the money for the research to other places. And so, like, people need to know that universities are actually now just turning into vast admin places, and that's where they make their money. So yeah, end of rant. Baumol's cost disease.
Thank you. And I think that's really interesting, Erin, and I think that makes a lot of sense about how we can't be any more productive. And I think that one of the things you do, and how you get change this and do anything about it, is you join a union. One of the things the unions, people always, and people would say to me, well, they're not, you know, they don't represent me, but they can only represent their members. And if you're not a member, they can't represent you or the group that you're involved in. So it's really important that we join our unions. And I think collective action and collective support is vital towards it. And that would feed into changing any legislation, because the government will engage with the union officials. But unless we tell them what we need, they can't do it. So I think joining union is vital. I also think talking to your colleagues is really important, and talking to other people who are in the same position as you. So if there's a support group in your university, or there's a group of academics, like, that was one thing. Everywhere I went, you would end up meeting people who were also precarious, and we would talk and we would discuss things, and you would find out, and they'd be like, well, I get money for this, or, you know, I actually get paid this for correcting an essay and you get paid this. You find out all these little extra bits that you don't know, and it can be really, really helpful. But it also lets you know, because academia is very isolating and very independent work, and you're often on your own, and it's really nice to have people to talk to. But I do think that, like, that having a group is really important, because that knowledge and that insider knowledge, you go into a new university, you don't know how all the things work. You don't know how to claim for this, or you don't remember how to, you know, I don't know, like, how to get the free laptop or whatever it is. And somebody else does know. So joining a group like that can be really great, where you can share information. But joining your union, I think, is vital, because I think, like, it's been my bugbear is to make the unions more aware of the issues around precarity. Because even, like, I remember when I went and I spoke to the union to ask them and talk to them about what was going on and what they were doing, they couldn't believe how little I was paid. And I remember one of the head people said to me, but, like, why do you do it? I was like, oh my God. And he's like, you're basically paying to go to work. And I was like, yes, I am. But it was really interesting, because I was kind of going, well, he doesn't know, because he doesn't have the members. And, you know, the voices need to be heard, and that's the stories need to come out, and the extent of this needs to be known. And in order to do that, to come forward, and you can do that, you know, secretly or anonymously, or, you know what I mean, you don't have to be, and when you're part of a union, you're not just, it's not just, you know, Mary against HR, it's the union against HR. So you're part of a group that can hopefully make some changes. But those would be my things to do, is to find a group locally, if not get one started, chat, you know, have that support, and secondly, join the union. I think those are two important things.
And tell your taxi drivers. That's what I do. Every time I have to get a taxi, I'm like, so do you know about academic precarity?
Yeah, as well. Yeah, tell everybody. Yeah.
Yeah.
Marina, do you have anything else? Otherwise, I have a very quick closeout question.
No, I was honestly, I would have said what Deirdre said about, you know, joining groups, joining your union. Don't make it easy for people to exploit you, you know, make it as difficult as possible. And that sort of, that collective, yes, collective action, but also that ability to share and discuss information is just invaluable. So yeah, that would be mine as well.
And to close the conversation off, I was approached by a couple of my undergrad students about references lately, and just reading their letters of motivation and just to see how they viewed academia, the question popped up in my head for us to answer to round up the conversation is, if one of your best undergrad students came to you now and said, I want to do a PhD, I want a career in academia, what would you tell them? Dara, do you want to go first?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, I suppose the answer is, do it if you want to do it, but don't do it in the hopes of becoming an academic. You know, I think that that's kind of all there is to it. And also, only do it if you can get funding, because otherwise it's not really worth it. I mean, it's, you know, as Miranda was saying earlier, it's just, it's so difficult because, you know, you're like, God, you're really great. You'd be so good at this. The world needs academics. Like, why the hell else do we make the poor sixth years go through the Leaving Cert if not to get to university and to have people teaching them at university? And yet we're constantly told, oh, I don't know, we don't have sympathy for lecturers, we only have sympathy for nurses, because, you know, you're swanning around in your ivory tower waiting for the people in the Supernatural TV show to show up and ask you about this particular myth or whatever. Like, it's not like that. And so it is, it's just, it is really difficult to answer those questions. And I think we need to acknowledge that it's difficult, that there is no easy answer to all of this, because someone has to do a PhD. And ideally, it should be the very good people, but they need to know that there are consequences to it.
Absolutely. Miranda, do you want to go next?
Yeah, I mean, I've had this conversation with people. Like I said, I co-supervise 3 PhD students, and I've spoken to other people who've been interested in doing PhDs, and I'm just generally honest with them. I tend to tell them, you know, like Dara, do it if it's something you really want to do, but like, be aware that you need to, you know, cultivate, transferable skills. I'm doing air quotes if anyone can see me, because it's such a buzzword, but like, you know, be aware that it's not going to lead necessarily or even likely to a career in academia. So I tend to be honest, but like, I've talked to, again, one of my kind of pet issues is kind of the idea of having more diversity within academia. And sometimes when I speak to students, like very good MA students who I know come from a similar background to me, who might come from working class backgrounds, I will often say to them, you know, academia needs more people like you. Academia needs that diversity. Academia needs people from different backgrounds with different perspectives. And, you know, you deserve to be here as much as anyone else. So, but at the same time, it is so difficult. And it's, I guess, kind of mediating that, you know, like on the one hand, encouraging students, especially students who might not ordinarily have been encouraged in this particular area, but at the same time, kind of tempering their expectations and not allowing them to go into academia thinking that it is a straight line to an academic position.
Absolutely. Deirdre?
I suppose I would say, and people say to me, I say, if you want to do a PhD, it's because you want to research something that you love. And that's why you do it. I'm very honest and say, look, you 3% of the people who do PhDs will go in to academic jobs. So if you're going to do it, it has to be a piece of research that you are willing to be sustainedly involved in over 3 to 5 years, and it's something that you love and want to achieve, because it is an achievement, a massive achievement, that you spend this much time and you research something, you contribute to knowledge. And I think that is, like, it's so I suppose, like, it's such a lovely thing to do, and it's such an admirable thing to do, and it is something that you should enjoy and love, and that's why you should do it. You shouldn't do it because you want to be a lecturer at the end. And like, and you, I think one of the things is that there is a sense that you do a PhD to be a lecturer. Yes, it is one of the requirements of the job to have a PhD, but you need to think about, I know we're on the transferable skills and that's, but that is part of it, that actually it's like people say, you know, oh, you're doing your arts degree, do you want to be a secondary school teacher? And, you know, it's not the case, because your arts degree can do all of these other things. I did an arts degree, I was a journalist, I worked in TV, I worked in sales, I worked in, you know, community development, I did loads of jobs. And so your arts degree can do loads for you, in the same way that your PhD can do loads for you. But you are learning project management skills, you're doing, you know, research, you're doing presentations, you're doing communication skills, you're learning to network, you're doing all these other things. So if you're going to do a PhD, you're going to have to do it because you really love this idea. You love this research. You love your area. You love your focus. And you're willing to do that for a sustained period of time and to have that achievement at the end. If you want to be an academic, this is one way. This is the way to start to do it. But it is a difficult job to get into, and I would give them the stats, and I would, like, many of them, people would say to me, I've read your article, so, you know, and I'm like, yeah, but that's what the situation was for me. And it's funny because, you know, I know people who have left their PhD and within 2 years gone into a permanent job, or I know people who were in different jobs and have now left, like amazing academics have left. So I think the way we see PhDs has to change massively, because this idea that a PhD is the start of an academic career is incorrect. But it can be the start of a number of different careers. It can be the start of anything, but it is an amazing achievement. And if you have the time and the ability and the money, or you have the funding, well, go for it. Because God, like, you know, I'm so proud that I did my PhD, and I'm still really proud that I have my PhD and that I did that, you know, that I went and I did that. I gave up a career and went back and did that. That was something I was so proud that I did, and I'm so glad that I did. The academic element of it afterwards was much more difficult, but, like, so if people are going to do a PhD, do it because you love it. Don't do it because you want to be a lecturer at the end.
And on that note, I want to thank all three of you for coming onto the show and making the season finale very special, sharing your experiences. I love that we raise awareness, that we get the word out there. So thank you, Deirdre, Miranda, and Dara, for taking the time to chat with me. I know we went a bit over time, but still. Now it's up to you, listeners. Let us know your experiences with precarity and how you manage it. As per usual, you can find the show on Instagram and Twitter at phdpenningpod, or write an email to phdpenningpod@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the episode, consider donating to our Buy Me a Coffee page so we can keep creating content for you. And just to end things, Deirdre, Dara, Miranda, where can people find you if they want to find you on the interwebs and learn more about your work? Do you have a Twitter handle or anything else?
You get me on Twitter. I'm Deirdre_Flynn. I follow 5,000 people, so it won't let me follow anybody new until I have 5,000 followers. So if you do follow me, I can't follow you yet. I will eventually. But Deirdre, Deirdre_Flynn on Twitter.
I had to go look it up, but I'm DaraD22 Gothic. Yeah, I'm there. I also edit very slowly. So sorry, Miranda, the Irish Journal of Gothic and Horror Studies. Editing an online journal is not conversant with having 3 to 4 jobs. But yeah, it will happen one of these minutes. So the Irish Journal of Gothic and Horror Studies is a very exciting, free, open access, non-exploitative academic journal.
I can second that. You can find me on Twitter as well at Middle Aged Witch. And I also write for Diabolique magazine quite frequently.
So thanks, everyone. And we will see all of you back for season 6 in a couple of weeks' time. Thank you.
Bye.
This episode of PhD Pending was written and produced by me, Anna Mahler. Artwork by Jerome Kelleher. You can find the show on Instagram and Twitter at phdpenningpod, or write an email to phdpenningpod@gmail.com. If you enjoy the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and make sure to rate us 5 stars so others can find it too. You can also donate on our Buy Me a Coffee page so we can keep creating content for you. The link is in the show notes.